dreadful burden to bear, and how horrible. Not for 30 years, not until I found the evidence among the tiles of Anson House, had anyone suspected it was murder. And they had almost got away with it. I reached out and touched Mr. Twining's tombstone to steady myself.
"I see you found him," said someone behind me, and at the sound of his voice my blood ran cold. I spun round and found myself face to face with Frank Pemberton.
Chapter 23. Whenever one comes face to face with a killer, in a novel or in the cinema, his opening words are always dripping with menace, and often from Shakespeare.
"Well, well," he will generally hiss, "journeys end in lovers' meeting," or "so wise, so young, they say, do never live long."
But Frank Pemberton said nothing of the sort. In fact, quite the contrary.
"Hello, Flavia," he said with a lopsided grin. "Fancy meeting you here."
My arteries were throbbing like stink, and I could already feel the redness rising in my face, which, in spite of the chills, had instantly become as hot as a griddle. A single thought went racing through my mind. I mustn't let on. I mustn't let on. Mustn't show that I know he's Bob Stanley.
"Hello," I said, hoping my voice wasn't shaking. "How is the Shroud Tomb?"
I knew instantly that I was fooling no one but myself. He was watching my face the way a cat watches the family canary when they're alone in the house.
"The Shroud Tomb? Ah, a confection in white marble," he said, "remarkably like an almond marzipan, but larger, of course."
I decided to play along until I could formulate a plan.
"I expect your publisher was pleased."
"My publisher? Oh, yes, old
Quarrington,"
I said.
"Yes, quite. Quarrington. He was ecstatic."
Pemberton, I still thought of him as Pemberton, put down his knapsack and began to unfasten the leather straps of his portfolio.
"Phew," he said. "Rather warm, isn't it?"
He removed his jacket, threw it carelessly across his shoulder, and jerked a thumb at Mr. Twining's tombstone.
"What's the great interest?"
"He was my father's old schoolmaster," I said.
"Ah."
He sat down and lounged against the base of the stone as casually as if he were Lewis Carroll and I were Alice, picnicking upon the River Isis.
How much did he know, I wondered. I waited for him to make his opening move. I could use the time to think. Already I was planning my escape. Could I outrun him if I took to my heels? It seemed unlikely.
If I went for the river, he'd overtake me before I was halfway across. If I headed for the field towards Malplaquet Farm, I'd be less likely to find help than if I ran for the high street.
"I understand your father is something of a philatelist," he said suddenly, looking unconcernedly off towards the farm.
"He collects stamps, yes. How did you know?"
"My publisher, old Quarrington, happened to mention it this morning over at Nether Eaton. He was thinking of asking your father to write a history of some obscure postage stamp, but couldn't quite think how best to approach him. Couldn't begin to understand it all, far beyond me, too technical. Suggested that perhaps he should have a word with you." It was a lie, and I detected it at once. As an accomplished fibber myself, I spotted the telltale signs of an untruth before they were halfway out of his mouth. The excessive detail, the off-hand delivery, and the wrapping up of it all in casual chit-chat.
"Could be worth a bundle, you know," he added. "Old Quarrington's pretty flush since he married into the Norwood millions, but don't let on I told you. I expect your father wouldn't say no to a bit of pocket change to buy a new guinea halfpenny thingamy, would he? It must take a pretty penny to keep up a place like Buckshaw."
This was piling insult onto injury. The man must take me for a fool.
"Father's rather busy these days," I said, "but I'll mention it to him."
"Ah, yes, this sudden death you spoke of, police and all that, must be a damnable bore."
Was he going to make a move, or were we going to sit here gossiping until dark?
Perhaps it would be best if I took the initiative. That way, at least, I'd have the advantage of surprise. But how?
I remembered a piece of sisterly advice which Feely once gave Daffy and me. "If ever you're accosted by a man," she'd said, "kick him in the Casanovas and run like blue blazes." Although it had sounded at the time like a useful bit of intelligence, the only problem was that I didn't know where the Casanovas were located. I'd have to think of something else. I scraped the toe of my shoe in the sand. I would grab a handful and toss it in his eyes before he knew what had hit him. I saw him watching me. He stood up and dusted the seat of his trousers. "People sometimes do a thing in haste and later come to regret it," he said conversationally. Was he referring to Horace Bonepenny, or to himself? Or was he warning me not to make a foolish move? "I saw you at the 13 Drakes, you know. You were inside the front door looking at the register when my taxi pulled up." Curses! I had been spotted after all. "I have friends who work there," I said. "Mary and Ned. I sometimes drop in to say hello."
"And do you always rifle the guests' rooms?"
I could feel my face going all scarlet even as he said it.
"As I suspected," he went on. "Look, Flavia, I'll be frank with you. A business associate had something in his possession that didn't belong to him. It was mine. Now, I know for a fact that, other than my associate, you and the landlord's daughter were the only two people who were in that room. I also know that Mary Stoker would have no reason to take this particular object. What am I to think?"
"Are you referring to that old stamp?" I asked. This was going to be a tightrope act, and I was already putting on my tights. Pemberton relaxed at once.
"You admit it," he said. "You're an even smarter girl than I gave you credit for."
"It was on the floor, under the trunk," I said. "It must have fallen out. I was helping Mary clean up the room. She'd forgotten to do a few things, and her father, you see, can be..."
"I do see. So you stole my stamp and took it home."
I bit my lip, wrinkled my face a bit, and rubbed my eyes. "I didn't actually steal it. I thought someone had dropped it." "No, that's not entirely true. I knew that Horace Bonepenny had dropped it, and since he was dead, he wouldn't have any further need for it. I thought I'd make a present of it to Father, and he'd get over being angry with me about the Tiffany vase I smashed. There, now you know."
Pemberton whistled. "A Tiffany vase?"
"It was an accident," I said. "I shouldn't have been playing tennis in the house."
"Well," he said, "that solves the problem, doesn't it? You hand over my stamp and it's case closed. Agreed?"
I nodded happily. "I'll run home and get it."
Pemberton burst into uncomplimentary laughter and slapped his leg. When he had recovered himself, he said, "You're very good, you know, for your age. You remind me of myself. Run home and get it indeed."
"All right, then," I said. "I'll tell you where I hid it, and you can go and get it yourself. I'll stay here, on my honour, as a girl guide." I made the girl guide three-eared bunny salute with my fingers. I did not tell him that I was technically no longer a member of that organisation, and hadn't been since I was chucked out for manufacturing ferric hydroxide to earn my domestic service badge. No one had seemed to care that it was the antidote for arsenic poisoning. Pemberton glanced at his wristwatch.
"It's getting late," he said. "No more time for pleasantries."
Something about his face had changed, as if a curtain had been drawn across it. There was a sudden chill in the air. He made a lunge for me and grabbed my wrist. I let out a yelp of pain. In a few more seconds, I knew, he'd be twisting my arm behind my back. I gave in at once. "I hit it in Father's dressing room at Buckshaw," I blurted. "There are two clocks in the room, a large one on the chimney-piece and a smaller one on the table beside his bed. The stamp is stuck to the back of the pendulum on the chimney-piece clock." And then something dreadful happened. Dreadful and, as it would turn out, quite wonderful, rolled together into one. I sneezed. My head cold had been lingering, nearly forgotten, for most of the day. I had noticed that in the same way they recede when you're sleeping, head colds often let up when you're too preoccupied to pay them attention.
Mine was suddenly back with a vengeance. Forgetting for a moment that the Ulster Avenger was nestled inside it, I went for my handkerchief. Pemberton, startled, must have thought my sudden move was the prelude to my bolting, or perhaps an attack upon his person. Whatever the case, as I brought the handkerchief up towards my nose, before it was even opened, he deflected my hand with a lightning-quick grab, crumpled the cotton into a ball, and rammed it, stamp and all, into my mouth. "Right, then," he said. "We'll see what we shall see." He pulled his jacket from his shoulder, spread it out like a matador's cape, and the last thing I saw as he threw the thing over my head was Mr. Twining's tombstone, the word valet carved on its base. "I bid you farewell." Something tightened round my temples, and I guessed that Pemberton was using the straps of his portfolio to lash the jacket firmly in place. He hoisted me up onto his shoulder and carried me back across the river as easily as a butcher does a side of beef. Before my head could stop spinning, he had dumped me heavily back onto my feet. Gripping the nape of my neck with one hand, he used the other to seize my upper arm in a vice-like grip, shoving me roughly ahead of him along the towpath. "Just keep putting one foot in front of the other until I tell you to stop." I tried to call out for help, but my mouth was jammed chock-full of wet handkerchief. I couldn't produce anything more than a swinish grunt. I couldn't even tell him how much he was hurting me. I suddenly realized that I was more afraid than I had ever been in my life. As I stumbled along, I prayed that someone would spot us. If they did, they would surely call out, and even with my head bound up in Pemberton's jacket, I would almost certainly hear them. If I did, I would wrench sharply away from him and make a dash towards the sound of their voice. But to do so prematurely, I knew, risked tumbling headlong into the river and being left there by Pemberton to drown. "Stop here," he said suddenly, after I had been frog-marched what I judged to be 100 yards. "Stand still." I obeyed. I heard him tinkering with something metallic, and a moment later what sounded like a door grating open. The pit shed. "One step up," he said. "That's right. Now three ahead, and stop." Behind us, the door closed like a coffin lid with a wooden groan. "Empty your pockets," Pemberton said. I had only one, the pocket in my sweater. There was nothing in it but the key to the kitchen door at Buckshaw. Father had always insisted that each of us carry a key at all times in case of some hypothetical emergency, and because he conducted the occasional spot check, I was never without it. As I turned my pocket inside out, I heard the key fall to the wooden floor, then bounce and skitter. A second later, there was a faint click as it landed on concrete. "Damn," he said. Good. The key had fallen into the service pit, I was sure of it. Now Pemberton would have to drag back the boards that covered it and clamber down into the pit. My hands were still free. I would rip his jacket off my head, run out the door, pull the handkerchief out of my mouth, and scream like old gooseberries as I ran towards the high street. It was less than a minute away. I was right. Almost immediately, I heard the unmistakable sound of heavy planks being dragged across the floor. Pemberton grunted as he pulled them away from the mouth of the pit. I'd have to be careful which way I ran. One wrong step and I'd fall into the open hole and break my neck. I hadn't moved since we came in the door, which, if I was correct, must now be behind me with the pit in front. I'd have to estimate a 180-degree turn blindfolded. Either Pemberton had a finely tuned psychic ability, or he detected some minute motion of my head. Before I could do anything, he was at my side, spinning me round 6 times as if we were beginning a game of blind man's bluff, and I was it. When he finally stopped, I was so dizzy I could barely stand up. "Now then," he said, "we're going down. Watch your step." I shook my head rapidly from side to side, thinking, even as I did so, how ridiculous it must look, swathed in his tweed jacket. "Listen, Flavia, be a good girl. I'm not going to hurt you as long as you behave. As soon as I have the stamp from Buckshaw in my hands, I'll send someone to set you free. Otherwise..."
"Otherwise?"
"I shall be forced to do something most unpleasant."
An image of Horace Bonepenny breathing his final breath into my face floated before my covered eyes, and I knew that Pemberton was more than capable of following through on his threat. He dragged me by the elbow to a spot I assumed was the edge of the pit.
8 steps down, he said.
I'll count them.
Don't worry. I'm holding on to you.
I stepped off into space.
1,
he said, as my foot came down on something solid. I stood there teetering.
Easy does it.
2, 3,
you're almost halfway there.
I put out my right hand and felt the edge of the pit nearly level with my shoulder. As my bare knees detected the cold air in the pit, my arm began to tremble like a dead branch in the winter wind. I felt a tightness gripping at my throat.
Good. 4, 5, just 2 more to go.
He was shuffling down the steps behind me, 1 at a time. I wondered if I could seize his arm and pull him sharply into the pit. With any luck, he'd crack his head on the concrete, and I'd scramble over his body to freedom. Suddenly he froze, his fingers digging into the muscle of my upper arm. I let out a muted bellow and he relaxed his grip a little.
Quiet, he said in a snarl that wasn't to be trifled with.
Outside in Cow Lane, a lorry was backing up, its gears whining in a rising and falling wail. Someone was coming! Pemberton stood perfectly still, his quick breath rasping in the cold silence of the pit. With my head muffled in his jacket, I could only faintly hear the voices outside, followed by the clanging of a steel tailgate. Oddly enough, the thought that came to mind was of Feely. Why, she would demand, didn't I scream? Why didn't I rip the jacket from my head and sink my teeth into Pemberton's arm? She would want to know all the details, and no matter what I said, she would rebut every argument as if she were the Lord Chief Justice himself. The truth was that I was having difficulty just managing to breathe. My handkerchief, a sturdy, no-nonsense piece of cotton, was stuffed so tightly into my mouth that my jaws were in agony. I had to breathe through my stuffed-up nose, and even by taking the deepest breaths, I was only just able to draw in enough oxygen to keep afloat. I knew that if I began coughing, I was a goner. The slightest exertion made my head spin. Besides that, I realized, a couple of men standing out there beside an idling lorry would hear nothing but the noise of its motor. Unless I could contrive something ear-splitting, I'd never make myself heard. Meanwhile, it was best to keep still and to keep quiet. I would save my energy. Someone closed the lorry's tailgate with a clang of steel. 2 doors slammed shut, and the thing lumbered off in first gear. We were alone again.
Now then, Pemberton said, down you go, 2 steps more.
He gave my arm a sharp pinch and I slid my foot forward.
7, he said.
I paused, reluctant to take the last step that would put me in the bottom of the pit.
1 more. Careful.
As if he were helping an old lady across a busy street. I took another step and was instantly ankle deep in rubbish. I could hear Pemberton stirring around in the stuff with his foot. He still had a fierce grip on my arm, which he relaxed only for an instant as he bent to pick something up. Obviously the key. If he could see it, I thought, there must be a certain amount of daylight at the bottom of the pit. The daylight at the bottom of the pit. For some unfathomable reason, the thought brought back to me Inspector Hewitt's words as he drove me home from the county constabulary in Hindley. Unless some sweetness at the bottom lie, who cares for all the crinkling of the pie? What did it all mean? My mind was a whirl.
I'm sorry, Flavia, Pemberton said suddenly, breaking into my thoughts, but I'm going to have to tie you up.
Before his words had time to register, he had whipped my right hand round behind me and tied my wrists together. What had he used, I wondered? His necktie? As he tightened it, I remembered to press my fingertips together to form an arch, just as I had done when Feely and Daffy had locked me in the closet. When had that been? Last Wednesday? It seemed 1,000 years ago. But Pemberton was no fool.
He saw at once what I was up to, and without a word, he pinched the backs of my hands between his thumb and forefinger, and my little arch of safety collapsed in pain. He pulled the bonds tight until my wrists were squeezed together, then double and triple knotted the thing, giving it a hard, tight tug at each step. I ran a thumb over the knot and felt the slick smoothness of it. Woven silk. Yes, he had used his necktie. Precious little chance of picking my way out of these bonds. My wrists were already perspiring, and I knew that the moisture would soon cause the silk to shrink. Well, not precisely. Silk, like hair, is a protein, and does not itself shrink, but the way in which it is woven can cause it to tighten mercilessly when it is wetted. After a while, the circulation in my hands would be cut off. And then... "Sit!" Pemberton commanded, pushing down on my shoulders, and I sat. I heard the click of his belt buckle as he removed it, whipped it round my ankles, and pulled it tight. He didn't say another word. His shoes grated on concrete as he climbed the steps of the pit, and then I heard the sound of the heavy boards being dragged back across its mouth. A few moments later, all was silence. He was gone. I was alone in the pit, and no one but Pemberton knew where I was. I would die down here, and when eventually they found my body, they would lift me into a gleaming black hearse and transport me to some dank old morgue, where they would lay me out on a stainless steel table. The first thing they would do would be to open my mouth and extract the soggy ball of my handkerchief, and as they spread it out flat on the table, beside my white remains, an orange stamp, a stamp belonging to the king, would flutter to the floor. It was like something right out of an Agatha Christie. Someone, perhaps even Miss Christie herself, would write a detective novel about it. I would be dead, but I'd be splashed across the front page of the News of the World. If I hadn't been so frightened, so exhausted, so short of breath, and in such pain, it might even have seemed amusing. Chapter 24. Being kidnapped is never quite the way you imagine it will be. In the first place, I had not bitten and scratched my abductor. Nor had I screamed. I had gone quietly along like a lamb to the September slaughter. The only excuse I can think of is that all my powers were being diverted to feed my racing mind, and that nothing was left over to drive my muscles. When something like this actually happens to you, the kind of rubbish that comes leaping immediately into your head can be astonishing. I remembered, for instance, Maximilian's claim that in the Channel Islands you could raise the hue and cry merely by shouting, "Haru, haru, mon prince, on me fait tort." Easy to say, but hard to do when your mouth's stopped up with cotton and your head's wrapped in a stranger's tweed jacket that fairly reeks of sweat and pomade. Besides, I thought, there is a notable shortage of princes in England nowadays. The only ones I could think of at the moment were Princess Elizabeth's husband, Prince Philip, and their infant son, Prince Charles. This meant that, for all practical purposes, I was on my own. What would Marie-Anne Pauzée Lavoisier have done, I wondered, or, for that matter, her husband Antoine? My present predicament was far too vivid a reminder of Marie-Anne's brother, cocooned in oiled silk and left to breathe through a straw. And it was unlikely, I knew, that anyone would come bursting into the pit shed to haul me off to justice. There was no guillotine in Bishop's Lacey, but neither were there any miracles. No, reflecting upon Marie-Anne and her doomed family was simply too depressing. I'd have to look to the other great chemists for inspiration. What, then, would Robert Bunsen, for instance, or Henry Cavendish have done if they had found themselves bound and gagged at the bottom of a grease pit? I was surprised by how quickly the answer came to mind. They would take stock. Very well, I would take stock. I was at the bottom of a 6-foot pit, which was uncomfortably close to the dimensions of a grave. My hands and feet were tied, and it would not be easy to feel my way around. With my head wrapped up in Pemberton's jacket, and doubtless tied tightly in position with its arms, I could see nothing. My hearing was muffled by the heavy cloth,
my sense of taste disabled by the handkerchief stuffed in my mouth. I was having difficulty breathing, and, with my nose partially covered, the slightest exertion used up what little oxygen was reaching my lungs. I would need to remain quiet. The sense that seemed to be working overtime was my sense of smell, and in spite of my wrapped-up head, the stench of the pit came seeping at full strength into my nostrils. At bottom, it was the sour reek of soil that has lain for many years directly beneath a human dwelling, a bitter scent of things best not thought about. Superimposed upon that background was the sweet odour of old motor oil, the sharp, undulating tang of ancient petrol, carbon monoxide, tire rubber, and perhaps a faint whiff of ozone from long burnt-out spark plugs. And there was that trace of ammonia I had noticed before. Miss Mountjoy had mentioned rats, and I wouldn't be surprised to discover that they flourished in these neglected buildings along the riverbank. Most unsettling was the smell of sewer gas, an unsavory soup of methane, hydrogen sulfide, sulfur dioxide, and the nitrogen oxides, the smell of decomposition and decay, the smell of the open pipe from the riverbank to the pit in which I was trussed. I shuddered to think of the things that might even now be making their way up such a conduit. Best to give my imagination a rest, I thought, and get on with my survey of the pit. I had almost forgotten that I was seated. Pemberton's order to sit, and his pushing me down, had been so surprising I had not noticed what it was that I sat upon. I could feel it beneath me now, flat, solid, and stable. By wiggling my behind, I was able to detect the slightest give in the thing, along with a wooden creaking sound. A large tea chest, I thought, or something very like one. Had Pemberton put it here in anticipation before he accosted me in the churchyard? It was then that I realized I was famished. I had eaten nothing since my skimpy breakfast, which, come to think of it, had been interrupted by the sudden appearance of Pemberton at our window. As my stomach began to send out little pangs of complaint, I began to wish I'd been more attentive to my toast and cereal. Moreover, I was tired. More than tired, I was totally exhausted. I had not slept well, and the lingering effects of my head cold were further choking off my oxygen intake. "Relax, Flav. Keep a cool head. Pemberton will soon be arriving at Buckshaw." I had counted on the fact that when he entered the house to retrieve the Ulster Avenger, he would be accosted by Dogger, who would put paid to him in no uncertain terms. Good old Dogger. How I missed him. He was this great unknown, living under the same roof, and I had never thought to ask him, face to face, about his past. If ever I managed to find my way out of this infernal fix, I vowed that, at the earliest opportunity, I would take him on a private picnic. I would punt with him to the Folly, where I would ply him with Marmite on bread and pump him like Billy Ho for all the gory details. He would be so relieved at my escape that he would hardly dare refuse to tell me all. The dear man had pretended that it was he who had killed Horace Bonepenny, albeit by accident during one of his spells, and he had done so to protect Father. I was sure of it. Hadn't Dogger been there with me in the corridor outside Father's study? Hadn't he overheard, as I had, the row that preceded Bonepenny's death? Yes, whatever happened, Dogger would look after it. Dogger was fiercely loyal to Father, and to me, loyal even unto death. Very well, then, Dogger would tackle Pemberton, and that would be that. Or would it? What if Pemberton actually made his way into Buckshaw undetected and gained entry to Father's dressing room? What if he stopped the chimney-piece clock, reached behind the pendulum, and found nothing there but the mutilated Penny Black? What would he do then? The answer was a simple one. He would come back to the pit shed and put me to the torture. One thing was clear. I had to escape before he could return. There was no time to waste. My knees popped like dry twigs as I struggled to my feet. The first and most important thing was to make a survey of the pit, to map its features and discover anything that might aid in my escape. With my hands tied behind me at the wrists, I could only map out the concrete wall by going slowly round its perimeter, my back steadied against it, using my fingertips to feel every inch of the surface. With any luck, I might find a sharp projection to use as a tool in freeing my hands. My feet were tied so tightly, I could feel my ankle bones grating together, and I had to invent a kind of hopping frog gait. My every move was accompanied by the rustling of old papers underfoot. At what I judged to be the far end of the pit, I could feel a current of cold air blowing on my ankles, as if there were an opening down near the floor. I turned and faced the wall, trying to hook a toe into something, but my bonds were too tight. Every move threatened to pitch me forward onto my face. I could feel that my hands were quickly becoming covered with a rancid filth from the walls. The smell of the stuff alone was making me queasy. What if, I thought, I could climb up onto the tea chest? That way, my head should be above the level of the pit, and there might be some kind of hook higher up the wall. Something, perhaps, that had once been used to suspend a bag of tools or a work light. But first I had to find my way back to the chest. Bound and tied as I was, this took far longer than I expected. But sooner or later, I knew, my legs would crash into the thing, and, having completed my circumnavigation of the pit, I'd be back where I started. 10 minutes later, I was panting like an Ethiopian hound and still hadn't come up against the tea chest. Had I missed it? Should I carry on or go back the way I came? Perhaps the thing was in the middle of the pit, and I had been tiring myself by hopping in rectangles all round it. But what I could recall of the pit from my first visit, although it had been covered with boards and I had not actually looked down into it, I thought that it could be no more than 8 feet long and 6 wide. With my ankles trussed, I could hop no more than about 6 inches at a time in any direction. Say 12 hops by 16. It was easy enough to conclude that with my back to the wall, the centre of the pit would be either 6 or 8 hops away. By now, fatigue was overtaking me. I was jumping about like a grasshopper in a jam jar and getting nowhere. Then, just when I was about to give up, I barked my shin on the tea chest. I sat down on it at once to catch my breath. After a time, I began moving my shoulders, back a bit and to the right. When I shifted to the left, my shoulder touched concrete. This was encouraging. The box was up against the wall, or close enough to it. If I could somehow manage to climb on top of the thing, there might be a chance I could throw myself up and over the rim of the pit like a sea lion at the aquarium. Once out of the pit, there would be far more likelihood I might find some hook or projection to help me rip Pemberton's jacket from my head. Then I would be able to see what I was doing. I would free my hands and then my feet. It all seemed so simple in theory. As carefully as possible, I turned 90 degrees so that my back was to the wall. I shifted my behind to the rear edge of the tea chest and brought my knees up until they touched the part of the jacket that was under my chin. There was a very slightly raised edge round the top of the chest, and I was able to hook my heels onto it. Then slowly, carefully, I began to extend my legs, sliding my back inch by inch up the wall. We were a right-angled triangle. The wall and the top of the chest formed the adjacent and opposite sides, and I was the shaky hypotenuse. A sudden spasm shot through my calf muscles, and I wanted to scream. If I let the pain overtake me, I would tumble off the box and likely break an arm or a leg. I steeled myself and waited for the pain to pass, biting the inside of my cheek with such ferocity that I tasted, almost instantly, my own warm, salty blood. "Steady on, Flav," I told myself. "There are worse things." But for the life of me, I couldn't think of one. I don't know how long I stood there trembling, but it seemed like an eternity. I was soaked through with sweat, yet cool air was blowing in from somewhere. I could still feel its draughty breath on my bare legs. After a long struggle, I found myself at last standing upright on the tea chest. I ran my fingers over as much of the wall as I could, but it was maddeningly smooth. Awkwardly, like an elephant ballerina, I rotated 180 degrees until I thought I was facing the wall. I leaned forward and felt, or thought I felt, the rim of the pit beneath my chin. But with my head swaddled in Pemberton's jacket, I could not be sure. There was no way out, not at least in this direction. I was like a hamster that had climbed to the top of the ladder in its cage and found there was nowhere to go but down. But surely hamsters knew in their hamster hearts that escape was futile. It was only we humans who were incapable of accepting our own helplessness. I dropped slowly to my knees on the tea chest. Climbing down, at least, was easier than climbing up, although the rough splintered wood and what felt painfully like a tin rim running round the top of the box made a hash of my bare knees. From there, I was able to twist sideways into a sitting position and swing my legs over the edge until I felt them touch the floor. Unless I could find the opening through which the cold air was entering the pit, the only way out was up. If there was, in fact, a pipe or conduit leading to the river, would it be of sufficient diameter for me to crawl through? And even if it was, would it be free of blockage, or would I suddenly crawl face first, like a mammoth blind worm, into some ghastly thing in total darkness, and become jammed in the pipe, unable to go either forward or back? Would my bones be found in some future England by a baffled archaeologist? Would I be put on display in a glass case at the British Museum, to be stared at by the masses? My mind raced through the pros and cons. But wait, I'd forgotten about the stairs at the end of the pit. I would sit on the bottom step and go up backwards, one step at a time. When I reached the top, I would push up with my shoulders and lift the boards that covered the pit. Why hadn't I thought of this in the first place, before I'd worn myself down to the state of quivering exhaustion? It was then that something came over me, smothering my consciousness like a pillow. Before I could recognize my total exhaustion for what it was, before I could muster a fight, I was vanquished. I felt myself sinking to the floor amid the rustling papers, papers which, in spite of the cold air from the conduit, now seemed surprisingly warm. I shifted a little as if to burrow into their depths, and pulling my knees up towards my chin, I was instantly asleep. I dreamed that Daffy was putting on a Christmas pantomime. The great hallway at Buckshaw had been transformed into an exquisite jewel box of a Viennese theatre, with a red velvet curtain and a vast crystal chandelier in which the flames of 100 candles bobbed and flickered. Dogger and Philia, Mrs. Mallet and I sat side by side on a single row of chairs, while nearby at a wood-carver's bench, Father puttered away at his stamps. The play was Romeo and Juliet, and Daffy, in a remarkable display of quick-change artistry, was playing all the parts. One moment she was Juliet on the balcony, the landing at the top of the west staircase, and the next, having vanished for no more than a blink of a magpie's eye, she reappeared on the mezzanine as Romeo. Up and down she flew, up and down, wringing our hearts with words of tender love. From time to time, Dogger would put a forefinger to his lips and slip quietly out of the room, returning moments later with a painted wheelbarrow spilling over with postage stamps, which he would dump at Father's feet. Father, who was busily snipping stamps in half with a pair of Harriet's nail scissors, would grunt without so much as looking up and go on about his work. Mrs. Mallet laughed and laughed at Juliet's old nurse, blushing and shooting glances at us, one and all, as if there were some message encoded in the words which only she could understand. She mopped her red face with a polka-dot handkerchief, twisting it round and round in her hands before rolling it into a ball and shoving it in her mouth to stop up her hysterical laughter. Now Daffy, as Mercutio, was describing how Mab, the fairy queen, gallops. "O lady's lips, who straight on kisses dream, which oft the angry Mab with blisters plagues, because their breasts with sweetmeats tainted are."
I took a surreptitious peek at Feely, who, in spite of the fact that her lips looked like something you might see on a fishmonger's barrow, had attracted the attentions of Ned, who was sitting behind her, leaning forward over her shoulder, his own lips pursed, begging a kiss. But each time Daffy flitted down from the balcony to the mezzanine below, in the role of Romeo, looking, with his pencil-thin moustache more like David Niven in A Matter of Life and Death than a noble Montague, Ned would leap to his feet with a volley of applause, punctuated by fierce two-fingered whistles as Feely, unmoved, popped mint imperial after mint imperial into her open mouth, gasping suddenly as Romeo burst into Juliet's marble tomb. "For here lies Juliet, and her beauty makes this vault a feasting presence full of light. Death, lie thou there."
I woke up. Damnation! Something was running over my feet, something wet and furry. "Dogger!" I tried to scream, but my mouth was full of a wet mess. My jaws were aching and my head felt as if I had just been dragged from the chopping block. I kicked out with both feet and something scuttered through the loose papers with an angry chittering noise. A water rat. The pit was likely swarming with the things. Had they been nibbling at me while I slept? The very thought of it made me cringe. I pulled myself upright and leaned back against the wall, my knees beneath my chin. It was too much to expect that the rats would nibble at my bonds as they did in fairy tales. They'd more than likely gnaw my knuckles to the bone, and I'd be powerless to stop them. "Stow it, Flav," I thought. "Don't let your imagination run away with you." There had been several times in the past, at work in my chemical laboratory, or lying in bed at night, when I unexpectedly caught myself thinking, "You are all alone with Flavia Deluce," which sometimes was a frightening thought, and sometimes not. This was one of the scarier occasions. The scurrying noises were real enough. Something was rummaging about in the papers in the corner of the pit. If I moved my legs or my head, the sounds would cease for a moment and then begin again. How long had I been asleep? Had it been hours or minutes? Was it still daylight outside, or was it now dark? I remembered that the library would be closed until Thursday morning, and today was only Tuesday. I could be here for a good long while. Someone would report me missing, of course, and it would probably be Dogger. Was it too much to hope that he would catch Pemberton in the act of burgling Buckshaw? But even if he was caught, would Pemberton tell them where he had hidden me away? Now my hands and feet were growing numb, and I thought of old Ernie Forbes, whose grandchildren were made to pull him along the high street on a little wheeled float. Ernie had lost a hand and both feet to gangrene in the war, and Feely once told me that he had to be... "Stop it, Flav. Stop being such a monstrous crybaby. Think of something else. Think of anything. Think, for instance, of revenge." Chapter 25. There are times, especially when I'm confined, that my thoughts have a tendency, like the man in Stephen Leacock's story, to ride madly off in all directions. I'm almost ashamed to admit to the things that cross my mind at first. Most of them involved poisons, a few involved common household utensils, and all of them involved Frank Pemberton. My mind flew back to our first encounter at the 13 Drakes. Although I had seen his taxi pull up at the front door and had heard Tully Stover shout at Mary that Mr. Pemberton had arrived early, I had not actually laid eyes on the man himself. That did not take place until Sunday at the Folly. Although there had been several odd things about Pemberton's sudden appearance at Buckshaw, I really hadn't had time to think about them. In the first place, he hadn't arrived in Bishop's Lacey until hours after Horace Bonepenny had expired in my face. Or had he? When I looked up and saw Pemberton standing at the edge of the lake, I had been taken by surprise. But why? Buckshaw was my home. I had been born and lived there every minute of my life. What was so surprising about a man standing at the edge of an artificial lake? I could feel an answer to that question nibbling at the hook I'd lowered into my subconscious. Don't look straight at it, I thought. Think of something else, or at least pretend to. It had been raining that day, or had just begun to rain.
I had looked up from where I was sitting on the steps of the little ruined temple, and there he was, across the water, on the south side of the lake. The southeast side, to be precise. Why on earth had he made his appearance from that direction? That was a question to which I had known the answer for quite some time. Bishop's Lacey lay to the northeast of Buckshaw. From the Mulford gates at the entrance to our avenue of chestnut trees, the road ran in easy twists and turns, more or less directly into the village. And yet Pemberton had appeared from the southeast, from the direction of Doddingsley, which lay about 4 miles across the fields. Why then, in the name of Old Stink, had I wondered, would he choose to come that way? The choices had seemed limited, and I had quickly jotted them down in my mental notebook. 1. If, as I suspected, Pemberton was the murderer of Horace Bonepenny, could he have been, as all murderers are said to be, drawn back to the scene of the crime? Had he perhaps left something behind? Something like the murder weapon? Had he returned to Buckshaw to retrieve it? 2. Because he had already been to Buckshaw the night before, he knew the way across the fields and wanted to avoid being seen. See 1 above. What if on Friday, the night of the murder, Pemberton, believing that Bonepenny was carrying the Ulster Avengers, had followed him from Bishop's Lacey to Buckshaw and murdered him there? But hold on, Flav, I thought. Hold your horses. Don't go galloping off like that. Why wouldn't Pemberton simply waylay his victim in one of those quiet hedgerows that border nearly every lane in this part of England? The answer had come to me as if it was sculpted in red neon tubing in Piccadilly Circus. Because he wanted father to be blamed for the crime. Bonepenny had to be killed at Buckshaw. Of course, with father a virtual recluse, it was unlikely to expect that he would ever happen to be away from home. Murders, at least those in which the murderer expected to escape justice, had to be planned in advance, and often in very great detail. It was obvious that a philatelic crime needed to be pinned on a philatelist. If father was unlikely to come to the scene of the crime would have to come to father. And so it had. Although I had first formulated this chain of events, or at least certain of its links, hours ago, it was only now, when I was at last forced to be alone with Flavia Deluce, that I was able to fit together all the pieces. Flavia, I'm proud of you. Marie-Anne Pauzet Lavoisier would be proud of you too. Now then, Pemberton, of course, had followed Bonepenny as far as Doddingsley, perhaps even all the way from Stavanger. Father had seen them both at the London exhibition just weeks ago, proof positive that neither one was living abroad permanently. They had probably planned this together, this blackmailing of father, just as they had planned the murder of Mr. Twining. But Pemberton had a plan of his own. Once satisfied that Bonepenny was on his way to Bishop's Lacey, where else indeed would he be going? Pemberton had got off the train at Doddingsley and registered himself at the Jolly Coachman. I knew that for a fact. Then, on the night of the murder, all he had to do was walk across the fields to Bishop's Lacey. Here, he had waited until he saw Bonepenny leave the inn and set out on foot for Buckshaw. With Bonepenny out of the way and not suspecting that he was being followed, Pemberton had searched the room at the 13 Drakes and its contents, including Bonepenny's luggage, and had found nothing. He had, of course, never thought, as I had, to slit open the shipping labels. By now he must have been furious. Slipping away from the inn unseen, most likely by way of that steep back staircase, he had tracked his quarry on foot to Buckshaw, where they must have quarrelled in our garden. How was it, I wondered, that I hadn't heard them? Within half an hour, he had left Bonepenny for dead, his pockets and wallets rifled. But the Ulster Avengers had not been there. Bonepenny had not had the stamps upon his person after all. Pemberton had committed his crime, and then simply walked off into the night, across the fields to the Jolly Coachman at Doddingsley. The next morning, he had rolled up with much ado in a taxicab at the front door of the 13 Drakes, pretending he had just come down by rail from London. He would have to search the room again. Risky, but necessary. Surely the stamps must still be hidden there.
Parts of the sequence of events I had suspected for some time, and even though I hadn't yet put together the remaining facts, I had already verified Pemberton's presence in Doddingsley by my telephone call to Mr. Cleaver, the innkeeper of the Jolly Coachman. In retrospect, it all seemed fairly simple. I stopped thinking for a moment to listen to my breathing. It was slow and regular as I sat there with my head resting on my knees, which were still pulled up in an inverted V. At this moment I thought of something Father had once told us, that Napoleon had once called the English a nation of shopkeepers. Wrong, Napoleon. Having just come through a war in which tons of trinitrotoluene were dumped on our heads in the dark, we were a nation of survivors, and I, Flavia Sabina de Luce, could see it even in myself. And then I muttered part of the 23rd Psalm for insurance purposes. One can never be too sure. Now, for murder. Again the dying face of Horace Bonepenny swam before me in the dark, its mouth opening and closing like a landed fish gasping in the grass. His last word and his dying breath had come as one. "Valet," he had said, and it had floated from his mouth directly to my nostrils. And it had come to me on a wave of carbon tetrachloride. There was no doubt whatsoever that it was carbon tetrachloride, one of the most fascinating of chemical compounds. To a chemist, its sweet smell, although very transient, is unmistakable. It is not far removed in the scheme of things from the chloroform used by anaesthetists in surgery. In carbon tetrachloride, one of its many aliases, four atoms of chlorine play ring around a rosy with a single atom of carbon. It is a powerful insecticide, still used now and then in stubborn cases of hookworm, those tiny silent parasites that gorge themselves on blood, sucked in darkness from the intestines of man and beast alike. But more importantly, philatelists use carbon tetrachloride to bring out a stamp's nearly invisible watermarks, and Father kept bottles of the stuff in his study. I thought back to Bonepenny's room at the 13 Drakes. What a fool I had been to think of poisoned pie. This wasn't a Grimm's fairy tale. It was the story of Flavia de Luce. The pie shell was nothing more than that, just a shell. Before leaving Norway, Bonepenny had removed the filling and stuffed in the jacksnipe with which he planned to terrorize Father. That was how he smuggled the dead bird into England. It wasn't so much what I had found in his room as what I hadn't found. And that, of course, was the single item that was missing from the little leather kit in which Bonepenny carried his diabetic supplies. A syringe. Pemberton had come across the syringe and pocketed it when he rifled Bonepenny's room just before the murder. I was sure of it. They were partners in crime, and no one would have known better than Pemberton the medical supplies that were essential to Bonepenny's survival. Even if Pemberton had planned a different way of dispatching his victim, a stone to the back of the head, or strangulation with a green willow withy, the syringe in Bonepenny's luggage must have seemed like a godsend. The very thought of how it was done made me shudder. I could imagine the two of them struggling there in the moonlight. Bonepenny was tall, but not muscular. Pemberton would have brought him down as a cougar does a deer. Out comes the hypodermic, and into the base of Bonepenny's brain it goes, just like that. It wouldn't take more than a second, and its effect would be almost instantaneous. This, I was certain, was the way in which Horace Bonepenny had met his death. Had he ingested the stuff, and it would have been a near impossibility to force him to swallow it, a much larger quantity of the poison would have been required, a quantity which he would have promptly vomited. Whereas 5 cc's injected into the base of the brain would be sufficient to bring down an ox. The unmistakable fumes of the carbon tetrachloride would have been quickly transmitted to his mouth and nasal cavities as I had detected. But by the time Inspector Hewitt and his detective sergeants arrived, it had evaporated without a trace. It was almost the perfect crime. In fact, it would have been perfect if I had not gone down into the garden when I did. I hadn't thought about this before.
Was my continued existence all that stood between Frank Pemberton and freedom? There was a grating noise. I could not tell which direction it was coming from. I swiveled my head and the noise stopped instantly. For a minute or more there was silence. I strained my ears but could hear only the sound of my own breathing, which I noticed had become more rapid and more jagged. There it was again, as if a piece of lumber were being dragged with agonizing slowness across a gritty surface. I tried to call out, "Who's there?" but the hard ball of the handkerchief in my mouth reduced my words to a muffled bleat. At the effort, my jaws felt as if someone had driven a railway spike into each side of my head. Better to listen, I thought. Rats don't move lumber, and unless I was sadly mistaken, I was no longer alone in the pit shed. Like a snake, I moved my head slowly from side to side, trying to take advantage of my superior hearing, but the heavy tweed binding my head muffled all but the loudest of sounds. But the grating noises were not half as unnerving as the silences between them. Whatever it was in the pit was trying to keep its presence unknown. Or was it keeping quiet to unnerve me? There was a squeak, then a faint tick, as if a pebble had fallen onto a large stone. As slowly as a flower opening, I stretched my legs out in front of me, but when they met with no resistance, I pulled them back up beneath my chin. Better to be coiled up, I thought. Better to present a smaller target. For a moment, I focused my attention on my hands, which were still lashed behind me. Perhaps there had been a miracle. Perhaps the silk had stretched and loosened. But no such luck. Even my numb fingers could sense that my bonds were as tight as ever. I hadn't a hope of getting free. I really was going to die down here. And who would miss me? Nobody. After a suitable period of mourning, Father would turn again to his stamps. Daphne would drag down another box of books from the Buckshaw Library, and Ophelia would discover a new shade of lipstick. And soon, too painfully soon, it would be as if I had never existed. Nobody loved me, and that was a fact. Harriet might have when I was a baby, but she was dead. And then, to my horror, I found myself in tears. I was appalled. Brimming eyes were something I had fought against as long as I could remember, yet in spite of my bound-up eyes, I seemed to see floating before me a kindly face, one I had forgotten in my misery. It was, of course, Dogger's face. Dogger would be desolate if I died. Get a grip, Flave, it's just a pit. What was that story Daffy read us about a pit? That tale of Edgar Allan Poe's, the one about the pendulum. No, I wouldn't think about it, I wouldn't. Then there was the black hole of Calcutta, in which the Nawab of Bengal had imprisoned 146 British soldiers in a cell made to hold no more than three. How many had survived a single night in that stifling oven? 23, I remembered, and by morning, stark raving mad, every last one of them. No, not Flavia. My mind was like a vortex, spinning, spinning. I took a deep breath to calm myself, and my nostrils were filled with the smell of methane. Of course. The pipe to the riverbank was full of the stuff. All it needed was a source of ignition to set it off, and the resulting explosion would be talked about for years. I would find the end of the pipe and kick it. If luck were on my side, the nails in the soles of my shoe would create a spark, the methane would explode, and that would be that. The only drawback to this plan was that I would be standing at the end of the pipe when the thing went off. It would be like being strapped across the mouth of a cannon. Well, cannon be damned. I wasn't going to die down here in this stinking pit without a struggle. Gathering every last ounce of my remaining strength, I dug in my heels and pushed myself against the wall until I was in a standing position. It took rather longer than I expected, but at last, although teetering, I was upright. No more time for thinking. I would find the source of the methane gas or die in the attempt. As I made a tentative hop towards where I thought the conduit might be, a chill voice whispered into my ear. And now for Flavia.
Chapter 26.
It was Pemberton, and at the sound of his voice, my heart turned inside out. What had he meant? And now for Flavia. Had he already done some terrible thing to Daffy, or to Feely, or to Dogger? Before I could even begin to imagine, he had seized my upper arm in a paralyzing grip, jabbing his thumb into the muscle as he had done before. I tried to scream, but nothing came out. I thought I was going to vomit. I shook my head violently from side to side, but only after